Senator John Burns be here, do you know?
I expect him Senator Burns.
Did he will? Would it be agreeable with a chair if we waited until Senator Burns was here?
Surely.
Thank you. All right, Nick.
Keith, what's called? What are you?
207.
207. You're trying to 207 then?
Hello, Richard.
Let me find out if Senator Burns is coming.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 207 is the result of a request from a citizen of the state of Oregon and not particularly in my constituency, who had written to a number of legislators apparently and had asked for consideration for a problem within the industry that he's closely associated. Well, Madam Chairman, there is a gentleman here who's on your list there, Mr. Shields, who has with him a couple of other, two or three other people in the industry that this speaks to, and I'm really not conversant with the problems these gentlemen are. I had the bill drafted because of their request, and I'm really not qualified to testify. No, ma'am. And if it's the pleasure of the chairman, the time that you continue the hearing on Senate Bill 207, Mr. Shields is here in the front row and other representatives of their industry that would like to testify as proponents of Senate Bill 207.
Well, Senator Burbidge, the only observation I would make is you made something. You're proposing to make something a crime that where there is no intent, you may no requirement that the state show intent or that the person have guilty knowledge. This is an unusual type of crime. Would you have any objection to there being inserted an intent and a knowledge?
Madam Chairman, I'd certainly have to defer to the legal wisdom of the lawyers on this committee and others in the legislature as to the proposal that you suggest, as long as it's in conformity with the rest of the provisions. In acts of this kind and still doesn't do violence to the original intent of the legislation. Now, this is certainly something that lawyers can hopefully come to an agreement upon. Sometimes lawyers don't agree.
Well, and you understand, in addition to not having intent and not having guilty knowledge, that it also is making two crimes.
207, you want to come?
It's a crime to have possession of a thing that doesn't have the number or altered number. Plus, you have the crime of maybe of having committed larceny. That's your intent, is it?
Madam Chairman, my understanding from communication with Mr. Shield is not the intent of the legislation to try to punish people who don't have any prior knowledge or intent to break the law. That's not the intent of the legislation. Is that not correct, Mr. Shield? And if it needs amendment to safeguard any innocent persons being entrapped in some legal altercation, well, that would certainly be agreeable with me.
Senator Keith Burbidge.
That's me.
Oh. We have probably a John Burns and Keith Burns. You meant John Burns.
Yeah.
They, There's another bill on this subject, this committee. Is that correct?
Not that I'm aware of right now, Senator.
Are you from the Mark community?
No. Oh, maybe, yeah. Prepare for the state bar office tonight, and you put it in the committee building. It's on business of Walgreens, serial numbers and manufactured goods.
But don't you think there ought to be an intent in it, or $1,000?
Yeah, maybe we'll get that bill looking together.
Wow. If I may respectfully suggest that while these people are here, they can certainly explain what the problems are that motivated the legislation.
Sure. Other questions, just in the room.
You can recognize how ill-prepared I am to defend this piece of legislation.
Thank you very much.
Did you get my editorial today?
Yes, thank you, John. I appreciate that very kindly. That was very thoughtful of you.
For the convenience of one of our fellow senators, we will turn to Seneca 130. Senator Mahoney?
Madam Chairman, this is a rather unique experience for me. Last time I appeared
on chairs.
This committee, why, I was chairman of the committee, and I've had some little experience in appearing before courts and before juries. And, of course, it's always settled policy to commence a jury speech with a few complimentary remarks to the jury and commiserate with them when they're serving for public and their arduous duties. So I'll do the same here because I know what you folks are going through. You know, I'm a member of a union, a closed shop union known as Oregon State Bar. It differs from other unions in that the members thereof do not have the protection of the Taft-Hartley Act. The bar was, Oregon State Bar, was instituted, I believe, in 1935. I was one of the practicing ones at the time the bar was so-called integrated. At that time, the bar dues were $6. The office of the bar was operated in the on building. Mr. Circum was the secretary. He's half salary and one full-time stenographer. The dues then, as I say, were $6. Up until 1959, the Legislative Assembly set the dues of the members of the bar because membership is compulsory. And 1965, I believe, when the dues were $30, Dean Bryson, who was now on the Supreme Court representing the bar, came to us and he asked for an increase of $20. They wished to inaugurate a program of attempting to suppress certain unethical practices on the part of a few attorneys who were, put it bluntly, ambulance chasers. At our suggestion, that he stated that $20 increase would only be necessary for 2 years, but at his request, there was no terminal clause put on the bill. We made a mistake. And then in 1967, some of you were present when the Senate Judiciary Committee passed out, the Senate approved, and all of the House approved, an addition of the dues in order to fund what we call the so-called Crooked Lawyers Bill, to set up an indemnity fund, and that was somewhat bitterly contested, and that passed. Since then, in 1969, I wish I'd been here, but I wasn't, the legislature permitted the bureaucracy of the Oregon State Bar, give them carte blanche, set the dues. They're up now, I don't know what they are. Senator Burns, what are they?
$86.
All right.
And there are now 3,500 active members of the Oregon Bar, plus 400 just admitted. Now, I have no this is not the time nor the place for me to comment on the income of the Oregon State Farm. Some of this bill was suggested to me by two or three respected members of the bar, men who have been in practice for 50 years. I sent and got a list of the members and found that there were 61 members now living who are paying dues on the active list who have been practicing more than 50 years. I was invited to visit a foreign country this summer or September to attend a meeting in the Oregon State Bar, but I didn't feel like I wanted to go up there and receive a 50-year certificate, so I told Miss Mailer to me. Eventually I got a real nice. But I'm speaking for myself, and particularly for distinguished members of the bar, other than myself, who wish to be known as in active practice, but feel that it's not fair that after serving the public and serving as a member of the bar for 50 years, they should pay the full due. Without mentioning his name, I have in mind one retired circuit judge who told me that he liked to serve maybe one or two or three days a year as a circuit judge pro tem. And in order to do that, he has to maintain an active membership. And practically, the net of what he received for that goes out for these dues. Now, as a matter of argument, we all know, we who are members of the bar, that the activities of the Oregon State Bar, and particularly the organization of the State Bar, has grown tremendously. And I dare say to those who are in the active practice, and particularly the newly admitted members of the bar, much of that material is bad. But to these people who have served 50 years, it's practically worthless. I'm talking about continuing legal litigation, things of that kind. So, this bill. Now, I was much impressed with a reply that Senator John Burns of this committee made to one or two of these members who wrote concerning that. As he expressed far better than I can, and I'm able to, a favorable opinion of this bill. Are there any questions?
Questions of Senator Mahoney. Senator John Burns.
I only have one observation, Madam Chairman. I'd like to have the Secretary make a verbatim copy of Senator Mahoney's testimony because I could not agree more. I think that it's regrettable that the Oregon State Bar has increased its dues to the unbelievable extent that it has. If we as legislators had permitted an increase in the budget of the state of Oregon, the extent to which they have inflated the bar dues, we'd be recalled, and rightly so. Now, I've had some question in my mind concerning the propriety of the legislature doing what is proposed by Senate Bill 130. But it's an integrated bar. It exists by virtue of a legislative act. As Senator Mahoney said, the legislature up until recent times set these dues. And it seems to me that it's appropriate that we set them again. And I'm going to propose at an appropriate time an amendment to this bill, because I don't think any member of my profession that has served for 50 years should pay any dues, and I think it's within the purview of the legislature to speak to that. But I feel very, very strongly about this, and those of you who know me, I think, can tell by the way I'm speaking how strongly I feel and how much I agree with Senator Mahoney here.
Senator Keith Burns.
Senator Burns, you're thinking of an amendment to eliminate any dues?
That's correct.
You want to make a motion?
Yes. Line 16.
May I inquire, Madam Chairman, each member of the committee receive a copy of these excerpts?
Yes, sir.
From various. And I've received, I may say, telephone calls, two or three, who didn't bother to write. very respected members of the bar. Names that I'm sure every lawyer here would know.
Yes, we've received many. Senator Burns, what is your amendment?
After the period on line 16, insert the word no. Following the word fees, strike the language in excess of $10 shall not be established. And following the word fees, insert shall be required or assessed.
Senator Burns has moved the amendment, which you heard him make, which in essence requires that no member of the bar need pay any dues to remain an active member of the bar. Is there a discussion of the amendment? All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
The amendment has passed. Thank you, Senator Mahoney.
Thank you, and if any of you ladies and gentlemen of the committee have any bills and want to pass through the rules and resolution,
Madam Chairman,
thank you all.
Make a note of that.
Madam Chairman, I wonder, I'm not going to make this motion, but I wonder what the committee would think of, on line 18, putting a period after law and striking the rest of the sentence.
Excellent.
Are there any other witnesses on Senate Bill 130?
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I brought no formal written testimony because I really came up to see if anybody else from the law enforcement council was going to testify on this bill, and I figured that if there was no one here, then I would tell the committee the reasoning behind the bill. Ed Cooper, who is director of the law enforcement council, is in the room. He's probably more qualified to speak to it, but in essence, the bill gives the power of those appointed to the law enforcement council by the governor, those legislators, the right to vote on matters pertaining to the law enforcement council. And as it stands right now, it's been an informal thing. We have not really had the power to vote on the council. We have been there kind of, I guess, as advisors and to keep in step with what the council is doing. The bill provides the legal basis for which we can cast a vote. In essence, that's it.
Senator Smith is vitally concerned with the separations of powers question and that legislators are not acting in judicial positions. Do you have any questions, Senator Smith?
Yes. I'll say one thing about this bill, should it pass. The President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House are going to have to be a lot more careful who they place on this judicial committee for this law enforcement.
Any other questions, Mr. Johnson? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there, Mr. Cooper, did you wish to?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Edward Cooper. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Law Enforcement Council, and at our February 1st and 2nd meeting of the Law Enforcement Council, the council unanimously voted to endorse this bill and to support it. And I'm here to give you the vote that the council took of that day. I might add that we usually hold our council meetings once a month, and they're usually a two-day meeting, which requires an extensive amount of the individual's time as they serve only for the reimbursement of their expenses. We feel as though the work of the council is extremely important, and the votes of the legislative members are important in matters that relate to the council work, and we highly endorse this bill.
Questions of Mr.
Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Did you have any choice other than to vote for it?
Did I have any choice other
Who
than
made
to
the
vote
motion?
For it? Oh, I can't vote. I'm a staff member.
Who made the motion?
The motion was made by, I believe, Mr. Underdahl, and seconded by Mr. Ellis.
What, review for me the composition of this committee.
It's a 25-member committee, of which three are legislators. Representative Lee Johnson, Senator
Ripper,
and Representative Lang.
And the judicial branch.
The representative from the judicial branch is Judge Hicks, the court administrator of the Supreme Court.
Further questions of Mr. Koop. Senator Hoyt.
Did your groups discuss at all whether it was constitutional to have a legislator vote on an administrative group?
Yes, this has been discussed, and in fact, we have on an informal basis at times let legislators and members of the courts vote on various issues that have been before the council, as long as no member of the council would object. If there was an objection from from a member of the council, his vote was stricken. This has been discussed by the council, and it also has been discussed by the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration office in Seattle and Washington concerning this. This is really why the bill is before you today.
Excuse me, Madam Chairman. My point is, did you discuss the Constitution of the
bill?
Yes, we
did.
Have to do with that?
Yes, we did. We felt that in regards to the constitutionality, as long as the work that we're doing pertains only to the council and the member that is sitting on that particular council represents the appointment of the governor and serves as a member of that council, that we really wouldn't be infringing on separation of powers.
The fact that the governor appointed the legislator or the judge makes it clean, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that. The fact that the business that is before the council is council business and is not really business of a legislative branch or an executive branch. Or judicial branch,
Madam Chairman, Mr. Cooper, Mayor of Portland sits on this body, right?
Correct.
Did you need any remedial legislation to tide you over to 75 when they abolished the city of Portland and his job? That leads to my second question. Do you think you will? I mean, he'll be abolished. His position will be abolished when the city is combined into county.
Consolidation.
Yeah, city county.
In that case, probably what will happen is that the governor will ask for a recommendation from that consolidated governmental body to appoint someone to serve on the council.
Well, what'll happen when we pass my bill and combine Oregon into 9 counties? Will you do that with all the other county commissioners that serve in the state?
Now, in terms of county commissioners and city officials that serve on the council, this usually the recommendations are received from the League of Cities and the Association of Counties, and certainly
you
for the
fielded that very well, Mr. Very well.
Further questions, Senator Keith Burns.
What's the budget of the law enforcement?
The operating budget or grants, Senator Burns? The operating
budget.
It's all federal funded. The support in terms of state contribution is in-kind match. Most of the in-kind match comes from the documentation of the various members on the council at attendance of meetings. Their time is considered as in-kind match.
What is your operation?
Pardon?
What is your operation?
For this biennium, or for the 73-75 biennium, I think we'll be asking for somewhere around $796,000. total budget is something over $24
million. $24 million.
Other questions of Mr. Cooper?
I wonder if I get a copy of that budget.
Could you supply?
Could we ask to have it referred to us, the budget?
Senator, what's your name? With a copy of the. With a copy of your budget.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Other persons on Senate Bill 260. Judge Branchfield, I wonder if we can have the benefit of your comments.
Madam Chairman, I'm Ed Branchfield on the governor's staff. I am a member of the Law Enforcement Council. I was present at the meeting that Mr. Cooper mentioned, and I voted in favor of supporting this bill. The original legislation, of course, was drawn this way because there was a fear that the legislative and judicial representatives might be exercising executive functions if they were to vote. When I first went on the council, I was state court administrator. We didn't know whether that applied to me or not. We simply applied the rule that Mr. Cooper mentioned, that if anybody objected, then I wouldn't vote. Nobody ever objected either to my vote or to any legislative votes. I think that the question whether it's constitutional, of course, is the, to my mind, that's really the only question, if it is constitutional. I'm inclined to think that it is, otherwise I wouldn't have voted that way as a council member. This is a, the function of the council is to distribute federal funds to state agencies, to units of local government for purposes in connection with law enforcement, using a very broad term there, a broad definition of that term. It does not actually operate any programs. If it operated, for instance, if there were a police force under the direction of the council, then I would feel pretty strongly that solely executive and therefore legislators and judges shouldn't vote. But it does not actually operate programs. It simply approves or disapproves, as the case may be, grant applications. And in effect, it is... it's almost advisory, although I've got to say it's more than advisory. So I'm not really sure of the constitutionality, but it seems to me that where there are funds dispersed to the judicial branch of government and funds dispersed to, there have been funds dispersed to the legislature, too, from this. So I look on it more as a cooperative sort of thing rather than a strictly executive function.
Would the federal language dealing with the law enforcement council be instructive at all?
Well, I haven't looked at that federal language for some time, Madam Chairman. That, of course, would not control over our own Constitution. But certainly is something that I think that we should take account of, and I think that since we're talking about most of this huge amount of money all this amount of money is federal dollars, so I think that we have to go along with the federal language, at least to the extent that our Constitution will permit.
Questions? Senator John Burns.
Well, Madam Chairman, Mr. Branchfield, before reorganization, when we had the State Public Welfare Commission, which made policy, and I'm a former member of the Law Enforcement Council, but when the State Public Welfare Commission made policy, and 55%, 55 cents of every public welfare dollar is federal,
Wouldn't that have been somewhat analogous to this? Now, I understand welfare runs its own department and law enforcement council is just a funnel, but it wouldn't have been appropriate, I don't think, to have had a legislative member as a member of the Welfare Commission or the Highway Commission or DEQ or Environmental Quality Commission, except for the one distinction you draw, and that is they run the departments and there's federal, and this is all federal money. But is that a sufficient distinction?
Well, if there is a constitutional distinction, I think that's it. That the old Welfare Commission did actually operate the Welfare Department. It not only set policy, it operated the department. The Highway Commission is the top administrative body of the department. So this is different. As you say, this, you described it as a funnel, which I think describes it very well. So if there is a constitutional distinction, it lies in that.
Further questions? Senator Hoyt.
You're familiar with the Employee Benefit Board. They're the ones that set up the health contracts for state employees. The language in the created that board commission is similar to the original language in this bill, and as I understand it, was put in there for the reasons mentioned about constitutionality. Now, I guess, so the same subject the answer to Senator Burns. There's really a difference in function between this particular law enforcement agency and the Health Benefit Commission Board, for instance.
Well, I'm not as familiar with that as I am with this. I think that, and I'm not sure whether it has any operating functions at all or not. This one,
it lets contracts and makes policy.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm familiar with it, but not anywhere near as familiar as I am with this. So I don't know. I think the legislature can, of course, keep this, even if it were constitutional, to allow them to vote, say, in the Law Enforcement Council. I think the legislature, if it desires to, can still prevent legislators and members of the judicial branch from voting. I think that's entirely up to the legislature. And that may be the may well be the case in the other board you mentioned, but I do not know whether they have any operating or really executive functions at all. But this council, unless you can say it's an executive function to decide whether you get money or whether you do, then I don't think it's an executive, actually carries out executive functions. Now maybe it does. I admit I have not made a. I've not researched the point on the law, and I did not expect to testify, and therefore I didn't do any research on it.
Thank you. It's a great courtesy to us to have you.
Well, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else on 260? We'll turn to 99.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you all for allowing me this opportunity to speak and represent.
State your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is John Turan, and I'm representing Senator Ted Helen on Senate Bill 99. I want to thank the members of the committee for this opportunity to express our views concerning this bill and try to show some arguments which will show you that it's necessary that the legislature pass this bill or a bill very similar to it. I've handed to the clerk an amendment to the bill which will exclude various persons from its operation. I've also asked that you be given some materials which I've had.
Since we don't have enough copies, do you have a copy of your amendment that you could read so the committee members know what you're talking about?
Oh, amendment is to the effect that except no fee will be awarded if a charge is dismissed after accused has entered a plea of guilty or has been adjudged guilty on a similar or related charge.
This follows the word purpose on line 8.
Then I'd like to describe to you first of all a situation, and then I'd like to get down to the arguments in support of the bill. Imagine a fellow who has been arrested for some kind of crime, maybe a felony or a misdemeanor, and he earns maybe $125 to $135 a week. He's a wife, he's got two children that he has to support. He probably owns, say, a 1969 Chevrolet, owns that free and clear. Otherwise, he's paying for his house, mortgage, and so forth. Has the usual kind of bills that a family man has. This man is arrested and charged with the commission, say, of a felony. At the time of his arrest, he's immediately advised that he has a right to counsel, and that if he hasn't got enough money to obtain his own counsel, why, the court will appoint a counsel, put a lawyer for him. Because of his particular financial situation, he isn't entitled to have a court-appointed counsel appointed for him. Therefore, he must employ his own lawyer, which means that his small savings or his small income has to go towards the paying for an attorney to represent him. Then assume that this man goes through the preliminary hearing stage and is finally indicted and eventually tried on the charge. And as a result of the trial, a verdict of acquittal is entered for him. Or another situation, assume that the court enters a judgment of dismissal because it appears that the state is unable to prove its case. Either the two situations are the same. The fact-finding determination is in favor of the fellow who has been arrested and accused and had to employ an attorney. A fact-finding that he was not guilty of the charge. He was innocent of the charge. Now, under the situation where a fellow has no money, who is unable to obtain his own attorney, the state provides an attorney for him. That fellow does not have to pay the state back for his attorney unless the court finds in certain circumstances that he's able to pay or will be able to pay in the future. You'll see from the materials that I've handed to you that there is a statute bearing on that question. In the other situation, there's the fellow who is arrested is wealthy, or at least he has enough money that he doesn't have to be concerned about what it's going to cost him or what it's going to mean to him or his family if he has to employ an attorney. I'm talking about the guy that's got money. But I'm talking about the middle-income guy who doesn't have a lot of money, who when arrested and accused of a crime, suffers a severe loss to his income, imposes upon the welfare of his family in order to obtain counsel to represent him on this charge, which later is proven that he's found not guilty. We have, under our statutes now, no remedy for such a person. I think that this legislature ought to provide it for him. I'd like to go to the materials that I've handed to you.
Let me just put note first for this first thing that's in here, which says it refers to Senate Bill 99, is obviously an error. It refers to some other bill.
First, both of them. Last paragraph.
Is it? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
The amendment, as you see, excludes the plea bargaining situation. That is a situation where a man might be charged with two or three criminal charges all arising out of the same transaction, or even different transactions. And in order to serve his own best interest, he will enter a plea to one of the charges, and the district attorney will agree and does dismiss the remaining charges. In that situation, this bill provides no relief for that person to be reimbursed his attorney fees or costs. Now, The materials that I've handed you include a law review article which was written by a man in the Nebraska Law Review. It's about 20 pages long, but I think it's a very important article that I'd hope that the committee members might have an opportunity to read before this matter comes to vote. I've attached also all the statutes that I could find dealing with the imposition of costs on the defendant in the state of Oregon, those that are authorized in the state of Oregon. You'll see that we've included the statute which authorizes the state to require that the defendant pay costs, and the statute provides that those costs will be assessed if it appears to the court that the defendant or the accused is able to pay them or will be able to pay them in the future. You'll see the statutes which require the appointment of counsel where the accused is indigent. You'll see where the statutes allow that indigents can also be required to pay attorney fees and costs in certain situations. But none of the statutes could I find, and in none of the statutes could I find a provision for attorney fees for the non-indigent accused who's later found innocent of the charge for which he is held. And we think that that is an injustice, that this should be corrected, that indeed it was corrected in a United States court. I'll call your attention in the case of U.S. versus McLeod, 385 Federal 2nd, 734, a 1967 case which involved a civil rights case where blacks were arrested, judicially harassed by the authorities because of their civil rights activities. And in that case, the court awarded attorney fees to the accused who were found not guilty in an effort to encourage them to participate in the voting process. We think that the enactment of this particular bill will act as a deterrent to insubstantial prosecution. That is to say, where a prosecutor has a weak case and he knows he's got a weak case and yet presents it to the court for trial on the hope that the jury or the judge or the fact finder will take him off the hook. Those kind of prosecutions should be discontinued, and this bill would tend to encourage that kind of result. The statutes which authorize the appointment of attorneys for indigents are quite narrowly applied. They are narrowly applied in Multnomah County, and they often preclude that person who is employed has a modest income, but and regards that person as not indigent, and thus requires him to furnish his own attorney. Generally, in the United States, the accused has to bear the cost of his defense, regardless of his innocence. There are one or two exceptions. Nebraska is one, and the United States Code has some exceptions, too. We think that the reasonable cost of one's criminal defense counsel should be awarded upon acquittal to those lower and middle-income defendants who are unable to qualify for state assistance as indigents or under the financial inability standard of the federal statutes. There is precedent for this outside of this country. The common law countries, England and Scotland, allow for the award of attorney fees and costs to a defendant who is found not guilty or innocent of the charge. In general, a fair-minded society should provide and pay for independent counsel to all indigent persons who are arrested on serious charges, and it also seems necessary that they should pay the necessary and reasonable defense costs of all accused persons, whatever their economic condition, were eventually found to be not guilty. Now, what does this bill cost? We've tried to get some statistics to help us with this bill, and we're compelled to fall back on a public pronouncement by the former district attorney of Multnomah County, who during the May primary stated that he had a 93% conviction rate of all those persons who were arrested, a 93% conviction rate. So you would just automatically take those out of operation of this bill, and you're left with the 7%. I don't know what the percentage is of non-indigence to indigence, but I would suggest that it would be very close to the estimates that were provided in the judicial report by the President's Commission, which showed that there were 55% of those people of that percentage were indigent, and therefore only 45% of those people were non-indigent and thus would be entitled to the award of attorney fees under a bill such as this. So we're not talking about a large number of people. It seems to me, I'm still thinking about this, it seems to me that the bill might yet be amended to an even more narrower class of people, to those persons who were found not only not guilty, but who are in truth, in fact, not guilty, based upon some kind of hearing of some sort. In any event, I wouldn't be objectionable to the committee narrowing the bill further than this, just to get the principle accepted by the state of Oregon, that the state will provide, will reimburse a person who expends money for defense of a criminal charge where he is found not guilty. I think this is a beneficial principle, and it's one that we should recognize in this way. We certainly are considering it in connection with reimbursement of victims of crimes. I don't know what that, I think there's a bill in the legislature concerning that, and it may well pass. And I think hand in hand with that should go a bill which authorizes reimbursement of a person for.
Questions of Mr. Turan?
Madam Chair.
Senator Smith.
I recently listened with the district attorney in Multnomah County. He told me that he has 4,000 cases of drunk driving now within his jurisdiction, and it's clogged the course to the point that they don't know what they're going to do with it. Would this bill affect a person who has been charged with drunk driving, who later, through a decision of the court, was considered not guilty?
Well, Senator Smith, I'd have to say, as the bill is presently drawn, that it would allow such a person to be awarded attorney fees. Now, I appreciate the numbers problem. I appreciate the numbers problem and the tremendous cost that implies. But we don't shirk these days, although we grumble a bit about it, about the tremendous cost that indigents impose upon the state and counties for their defense. And it seems to me that the same criterion should be applied to those persons who are mentally able to supply their own attorney. Why shouldn't they be reimbursed? Why should they have to stand the full expense of a charge that shouldn't have been brought against them in the first place, since they were innocent? Why should they bear that burden? And that's the argument that I would make to that. If this committee thinks that this kind of case should be eliminated from the operation of this this bill, then by all means, I'd be willing to go back and hash it over and try to draw something along those lines. But it's the principle that I'd like to see accepted, no matter how narrowly it's defined.
Senator John Burns.
Madam Chairman, in 1967, I sponsored a bill which would permit a modification of the current law to require costs and attorney's fees assessed against the defendant. This is the inverse of that. There was a constitutional problem with that bill, and we had some legal authority to the effect that you couldn't do that. I don't know whether the constitutional argument would be applicable in the inverse fashion here. I'd like to have Mr. Dwinner get the authority that was in front of the Judiciary Committee then. I just want to make one brief comment in response to what Mr. Turan says. It's the man in the middle, the working man, that takes it in the chin on these criminal cases. There's a lot of merit in what you say, because if you're an indigent, and you can convince the judge to appoint an attorney for you, you can get the best legal counsel there is if the crime is serious enough, and you can sail right through and get it all paid for now under the way we've amended the indigency statute. On the other hand, if you have a lot of money, you can get your expenses paid for. But if you're working and you got a family, you got to pay your own attorney's fees, and you're not going to get anybody to represent you competently unless they get a $1,500 retainer. I think there's merit in this, John. If the constitutional problems can be overcome, the question in my mind whether the money should come out of the general fund or whether it should be assessed against district attorney's budget, which is partially county and partially state. But conceptually, you help that man in the middle, and nobody knows perhaps better than you and some of us here how unfair it is under the present system.
Senator Keith Burns.
Well, conceptually, I agree also. I see we've discussed some problems with this earlier, and I'm still concerned about them, and I think it needs a lot of thrashing over. But I see other benefits, and I think wage loss ought to be included, frankly. And this would make district attorneys less likely to impose the release on bail in cases where it's unnecessary. This could be eliminating crimes and violence and so forth. The other thing is, it's going to make, if this is handled like it is with an indigence, where the attorney has to file an affidavit and document the time, I should think it would also cause district attorneys, like some we have, open up their files and not have things set down for preliminary hearings. So then when you get down there, maybe you travel 100 miles, get the court to do it, find it, taking it off the docket, taking it over to the grand jury, I can see it having a lot of other benefits in addition to cut down costs for everybody in the court system as far as criminal justice is concerned. So I agree with it conceptually, but it's got a lot of hooks in it that I think we have to work out.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chairman, I would be most happy to respond to any direction that this committee might give me with respect to how this bill should be drafted.
Well, Senator Smith brought up a serious question last time. Say that you had a man on three counts, and as district attorney, you finally came to a negotiation settlement where he pleaded to one and two were dismissed. Isn't there going to be a conflict between the defendant and his attorney as to what he's going to do?
Well, I think I hear you saying, Madam Chairman, that the attorney who will be compensated for his efforts in his case might be prejudiced against his client. Well, there are two things operating against that. First of all, the attorney acts presumably on a basis of standard of ethics, which would prohibit that, and he cannot allow any interest personal to himself to interfere with the proper representation of his client. That's the first answer to that. Secondly, I think that even in that situation, it would seem to me prudent to the client that he'll accept the district attorney's offer if he thinks that that's to his best interest. And he will forego any attempt to hold out in an effort to get his get attorney fees for his client. I don't.
You don't see any problem there?
No, I don't. No, I do not.
Other questions of Mr. Torres?
Is this the waiver problem that was suggested to the committee before?
No, it's not the waiver problem.
That was another.
Thank you, Mr. Torres.
Thank
other
you.
Persons on Senate Bill 99 will turn to Senate Bill 193.
Madam Chairman, before I leave, would the committee like me to bring back to you a revised form of this bill for presentation?
committee has instructed its counsel to look into the constitutionality, if you can lend anything to these efforts or the constitutional questions, it would be welcome.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Kirtley. I'm an attorney. I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 193 on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. The ACLU strongly opposes Senate Bill 193. The bill authorizes a district attorney or a peace officer to obtain from a bank any information concerning a check or the account upon which it was drawn. The only limitation upon a district attorney's or a peace officer's right to such information is that he must possess a check which is the subject of a criminal investigation. Senate Bill 193 authorizes an unwarranted and perhaps unconstitutional invasion of an individual's privacy. A person writing a check or making a deposit assumes that these transactions are no one's business but his own. His checking account is a reflection of his private life. Contains information about the groups he joins, the publications to which he subscribes, the books he buys, and the causes he supports, all of which he may prefer to keep secret. Under regulations issued pursuant to the Bank Secrecy Act, banks are now required to maintain records sufficient to reconstruct a checking account for a period of 2 years. Thus, an immense amount of information about an individual's financial history is available in his bank. Traditionally, the guarantee of confidentiality and privacy has been considered the heart of the relationship between a bank and its customer. Senate Bill 193 would violate this relationship by opening an individual's banking transactions to scrutiny by a public official. In effect, Senate Bill 193 gives a public official a general warrant to view bank records if he possesses a check drawn on the individual's account. The bill sets no limits on what is subject to search and provides no notice to the individual whose accounts are opened. Further, it provides for no independent review by a judge or magistrate to establish probable cause for a search of bank records. If Senate Bill 193 required an individual to surrender all his banking records at the request of a district attorney with only a check in his possession, it would clearly authorize an unreasonable search and would be clearly unconstitutional. Even in its present form, requiring a bank to surrender its records, the bill might be unconstitutional with respect to the individual whose account is searched. Although the ACLU is primarily concerned with the rights of the bank's customers, it considers that the bill might authorize an unreasonable and unconstitutional search with respect to the bank as well. Under the Bank Secrecy Act, a bank is required to maintain extensive records for each account, and having to produce them all upon request could prove unduly costly and burdensome. Not only does the bill authorize an invasion of privacy, but it does so to no good purpose. The district attorney does not need the authority granted in Senate Bill 193. Under present law, he can obtain necessary evidence from banks by use of either the subpoena or the search warrant. It should be noted that the ACLU objects
to the present law in this respect, for it does not require that advance notice be given to the individual whose account is searched, and thus it does not afford him the opportunity to contest the appropriateness of the legal process. However, the present law offers considerably more protection of an individual's privacy than Senate Bill 193.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Kirkley?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Smith.
I wonder how you feel about the public disclosure bill that's being discussed currently in this session. Do you know about it?
I'm just vaguely aware of it. I've heard Attorney General Lee Johnson. I think that some governmental acts should be conducted in private. I don't know exactly when, where. We have the example of perhaps the Paris Peace Conference. I don't know what the bill states.
What would you think about a provision of law which would provide that legislators should open up their own private bank accounts, and their own private life to the public? Do you agree with that?
Well, I think a legislature has, in a way, stepped into the public limelight and has asked to be examined and to stand before people, and people accept him, and perhaps these are things that should be considered.
It's interesting that you'd recognize the fact that a legislator is not an individual.
Further questions of Mr. Kirkley? Thank you, Mr. Kirkley. Senator Carson?
Thank you.
Is Mr. Crawford
Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Lee Crawford, a Salem attorney, senior partner in the firm of Crawford, Garrett, and Seidemann. We are general practitioners, and I am a general practitioner. However, I'm also a local attorney for the United States National Bank of Oregon. A great deal of my time is devoted to the bank's business. I'm responsible for the legal work in 13 different branches in the area. Have a bank phone on my desk where I can reach or be reached by anyone in the system practically. And I might say, in conjunction with the affairs of that client, I've long since found out my business is not to win lawsuits, but to make sure they never happen in the first place. So the record will be straight. Senate Bill number 193 was introduced by Senator Carson at my request. While the bank as such is not sponsoring the bill, I do have the bank's blessing to be here testifying in favor of it. Our problem, which gave rise to Senate Bill 193, is this. The bank is continually getting letters, either from district attorney's office or sheriff's offices, telling us that they have a dishonored bank check. They're making an investigation to see if a crime has been committed and asking for specific information. How, under the present law, we couldn't simply answer those letters without considerable exposure because to liability. Because there is very substantial case law holding that it's an implied condition in our dealings with a depositor that their accounts be kept confidential. If we respond to those letters
giving this information to the law enforcing officers. I have no doubt in the present law the time would come when we might have some litigation. Now, the present policy of the bank with respect to a customer's affairs is very limited. We will respond to normal requests for credit information, assuming it comes within the scope of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Now, to aid the payee or holder of a dishonored check, we'll only give out the following information. Whether the check would be honored if presented at the time of inquiry, the drawer's address and phone number, drawer's place of employment, and any identification taken when the account was opened. That's the limit on information which we give out now. It places quite a handicap on the law enforcing officers in determining whether a crime has been committed or not. I understand that banks generally do not have an exact established policy with respect. Some, I understand, simply take the chance and answer the letters. Others give absolutely no information. In my case, especially if simply a mistake has been made rather than a crime committed, or if there's mitigating circumstances which I feel the officer should know about in making up their mind whether to prosecute or not, I usually call them up and say, you know, I can't tell you anything until you've subpoenaed our records. But when you subpoena our records, you'll find so-and-so and so-and-so. Especially if there's mitigating circumstances or simply a mistake's been made rather than a crime committed. Now, for instance, let's say one of our depositors makes a deposit in the Tillamook branch for credit to his account in the Ladenbush branch in Salem. If it's not MICA encoded, it has to come by mail, the Tillamook branch to the Ladenbush branch, then go through the necessary functions in the Ladenbush branch to be credited. It has happened where the check he wrote against that deposit got to the Ladenbush branch before the deposit did. Consequently, it bounced. Well, I certainly feel that the law enforcing officer ought to know that before he filed a complaint. We also have mitigating circumstances where the drawer of a check and a payee get into some sort of a hassle, and instead of putting a stop payment on the check, the drawer just closes out the account. I feel that the law enforcing officer should have that information in determining whether he should prosecute or not. Of course, on the other side of the coin, we have cases where there's no substantial doubt. For instance, if the bank has closed an account in July, sent proper notice to the depositor, his overdraft's been charged off and it's been called to his attention several times, and he writes a check on that account in September, there wouldn't be much question but what a crime had been committed.
Questions of Mr. Crawford? Thank you, Mr. Crawford.
Thank you.
Senator Carson, did you wish to testify?
No, Madam Chairman. I think the...
Well, if you'd look at the bill, I have a question I'd like to ask you.
Oh, fine.
Normally, it says when a certificate or attorney or peace officer possesses, how about pinning it down further and saying he must also show the check and that the information given be limited to the check. I mean, the way it's written, any peace officer can come in and say, I possess a check on Joe Jones' account, and I want to look at his, all of his dealings with the police.
Madam Chairman, I think I can speak for Mr. Crawford. I'll hear from him if I can't. I encourage the committee to alter the language to speak more precisely. If that's the case, I have no pride of authorship in the particular piece. And if this seems to be too broad, I would have no objection to honing it down.
Well, don't you think you could come in and say, I have a check on Joe Jones and I want to see his accounts?
Well, yes, I think he could. I think that's the intent of it. If the district attorney is investigating a matter and he possesses a check, and it has to be a subject of a criminal investigation, and then I think, according to this bill, he'd be entitled to ask the bank for information about the check or about that account. And I think that's appropriate.
Any other questions?
I'm concerned about this matter about information contained in the bank's records concerning the check or the account. It looks like that's terribly broad. In a sense, isn't that asking a person to testify against themselves on a myriad of things other than just whether that check's any good or not? Isn't that a first-class fishing expedition license?
Well, I suppose it could be. I had not looked at it in that manner.
That's what it says, doesn't it?
Oh, clearly. It certainly does. It says any information contained in the bank's records concerning the check or the account upon which it is drawn. Yes, I suppose it could be a fishing expedition, much like the subpoena could be a fishing expedition that they could get and do it now.
And I'm sure it couldn't have fishing on something other than the check at hand. Something about the person. Records.
Well, it would have to be, would seem to me to be the subject of the check would have to be a subject of a criminal investigation. I think we could think of several examples that it's not an NSF or fraud or some other criminal fraud or some other area that perhaps the person is interested in. But I would think by and large, the way I understand the bill and the direction of it, the check would have to be a part. The check itself would have to be the subject of the criminal investigation in order to be able to get the records. And that would be germane, I think.
I'm not sure. I don't know enough about this to ask a sensible question, but just supposing that I was a drug peddler and I gave you a check that bounced and you went to law enforcement officer and he'd take, under this authority, he could look and see what I've done with my money for 2 years.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how they could. You get your checks back normally every 30 days, and I don't think it's the practice of any bank, Lee, is it, to photocopy checks? Oh, you'd have your monetary transaction.
Is that correct?
Oh, definitely.
They're all
photocopied.
Okay. So your answer is yes. Yeah.
You wouldn't
look that. Well, I have no objection to it. One of the things I was listening to Mr.
Well, if you're a dope peddler, I'm going to get you.
I bet you. Yes, if you're selling drugs.
I don't care how I do it. I'm not a member of the ALC.
ACLU. Or that either.
Or whatever.
For the
question of the sender cars. One thing, Madam Chairman, I might point out, I'm listening to the last part of Mr. Kirtley, I believe I've said that right, discussion of the bill. I realize this is a very sensitive area dealing with the bank records. The committee might well like to look into what we do in inheritance tax with the bank right now. I'm sure you're all aware that the state of Oregon is the first one to your safety deposit box and to your bank account and savings account, and I haven't heard ACLU speak to that issue. Perhaps they would like to have a bill in on inheritance tax as well.
Senator Johnson.
Well, you do agree, though, Senator, that it's unnecessary to have the words "or peace officer" in line A, don't you? I mean, this is our old continual fight on.
Yes, I would take it as a personal favor if you would take out peace officer here, and you have my encouragement to take it out the rest of the statutes as well. Yes,
we're right on there.
Yes,
Senator John Burns moved to delete "or peace officer" on line 8. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed.
Yeah, we don't need line 7 to do that.
Yes, line 7.
Senator Keith Burns moves to delete all the material on line 7. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passed. Any further questions, Senator Carson? Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Roberts?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Phil Roberts, Coordinator for Oregon District Attorneys Association. My comments will be extremely brief. First of all, I will say that the association has not had a formal meeting since this bill was filed, so I do not have a vote that I can give you as an official action. But various of the district attorneys have discussed this issue before, and I can say without fear of contradiction, I'm sure that they do generally support this legislation. Primarily to establish uniformity, I know from my own experience that there is a great deal of variation across the state in how this question is handled by local banks, and it does come up all the time. The biggest problem is that the banks are not now guaranteed immunity against civil liability. Many of them are afraid they could be involved in a great deal of litigation, and so they refuse to respond until a subpoena is issued for a grand jury hearing, which simply results in a lot of expense, which the banks don't like. Neither do the district attorneys, neither does anybody else. So we are in favor, and I would agree wholeheartedly with the two amendments that have already been made to restrict it somewhat. And we would also have no objection, as far as the district attorneys are concerned, to restricting the language to the investigation of the particular check involved.
I would, so, I would make an motion.
Well, how about including that they also have to show can't just say they possess it, but they have to show.
I think so.
So we have language drafted to show and limit the disclosure to the particular check?
I think the latter part, Madam Chairman, could be handled by inserting a period after the word check on line 12 and deleting the remainder of the sentence. If you think it appropriate, I would make that amendment, and then also, as part of it, ask that Mr. DeWinter draft the additional language.
Madam Chairman.
Let's have Mr. DeWinter. It seems to me that accomplishes our purpose to put the period after check.
You should put an end with his accomplishment.
Peace officer out of line 10, too.
Might as well change my to May on line 10.
Right. All those in favor of deleting or peace officer on line 10, pursuant to Senator Smith's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It passes. All those in favor of removing the comma after check?
I think I put an and in it.
Putting and in line 11. All those in favor of Senator Hoyt's motion say aye.
Aye, yes.
Opposed? It passes. All those in favor of putting pursuant to Senator John Burns' motion, a period after check on line 12 and deleting the remainder of the material or the account upon which it was drawn, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It passes. Mr. Roberts, you want to say something?
Sure. Yes, I just have a brief comment. The only concern I would have at this point is that there not be any problem with using photocopies, because sometimes you have to deal with a bank by mail and you can't present the check itself if you use photocopies.
So, Mr. DeWinter, will you put something
if
in there that would cause them to show the check or a photocopy?
If that's clear in the committee meeting minutes, it might be sufficient. I don't know. So it'd be no problem. I think I have no further comments. I have one copy of my comments. I was unable to get more prepared.
Senator Keith Burns.
How many checks come into DA's office every Monday morning?
Well, that's something that I can't say, because I don't know about other offices. I know I was in a small county, when I was a DA in Crook County. And we normally didn't get very many on Monday mornings. They usually came in later in the week. I mean, we didn't get the weekend rush like they might in larger counties.
We don't do that sort of thing in Crook County.
What was Tommy's name? He used to be security officer for Safeway. Tommy used to be an OLCC officer. He used to come in with about 250 Safeway checks every Monday morning.
And Fred Meyer, too.
Yeah, and then there'd be certain taverns that come in with 100 checks every morning.
Tom Sharon.
And I think the DA's office, in the course of a week in Multnomah County, they must have had 1,500 checks a week come in with stacks of them. And I suggest that you could index all those and you could get information on half the people in Multnomah County. Or in the course of a year.
Is that a question?
Did you book my bill to put the guy in cash?
What's wrong with that?
You remind me of the publisher of the Oregonian, but instead of people
Will
ought to have
the Senate Bill 207.
He says, what have they got to hide?
Give me that, Chairman. It's about to attack you.
Shields.
Madam Chairman, I have a question of you.
Yes, sir.
Senator Ivers hasn't been voting. I want to know what his stand is. I always draw that.
It depends. No, it depends on whether period, the date of the month, whether I'm overdrawn or not.
Senate Bill 207, Mr. Shields.
While you're correcting all the mistakes in that previous one, they might correct the spelling on line 10 there.
State your name for the record.
I'm Chairman. My name is L.R. Shields. I suppose to talk about this bill, I should tell you how it first came about. We are wholesalers. We have several hundred small dealers in the state, and most of you know them as mom-and-pop operations.
Wholesalers of what?
Wholesaling of, personally, what do we wholesale? Chainsaws, lawn garden equipment, various other equipment of this type.
What company, Mr. Shields?
Lucky JT Distributing Company. And my dealers have been harassed for years on break and entry. Some of them have reached a place now where they no longer can acquire adequate insurance. And this bill was put forward at their request to give a law enforcement officer some type of control on this theft. I will give you an example. A police force recently called us, asked where the serial numbers were on chainsaws. So I told him where they normally were. He called back and said, they aren't there anymore. Now this gentleman, I don't know whether he was, how he acquired these units. He had 20 of them. There was nothing the police could do, even though he's a three-time loser, but I suppose you're not supposed to talk about that. But we have so many small businessmen that are being driven out of business by the fact that they have been broken into as high as six times. There's no way for them to recover. But the bill is much broader than that. It covers any item that a manufacturer puts an original serial number on. There have been people in certain trades that have shown up with dozens of television sets. There's no serial numbers on them. So consequently, the law enforcement officers can do nothing. Now, they sell these to merchants somewhere in the state. The merchant that buys them is just as guilty as the man that stole them. I realize the way this bill is written that it puts more of a strain on business people like myself or the people that are requesting this bill than it does anyone else. We have to keep records. Normally we do anyhow. It also puts a strain on them that if they take a piece of merchandise in for repair, doesn't have a serial number, they must notify the sheriff who the customer is, and that they describe the product and that it has no serial number. Some way, and I don't know the way,
we have to protect these small business people or they won't be around much longer. Now, let's address ourselves to the one question that seemed to come up of innocent people, some way being trapped by this law. I'm not an attorney, but when I buy a piece of merchandise, a refrigerator, something like this, and I think you're all aware of the homes that have been stripped from one end of this state to the other, I know where I bought it. Let's say I lost the bill of sale. I can still go back to the merchant because this law, he will keep the serial number on record. I can prove where I bought that refrigerator or television set or any other item that might be stamped with a serial number from the original manufacturer. I realize that there's certain products manufactured, shipped in this state that have no serial numbers. Well, there's no way that I know that you can protect them with the law. We also have seen many people, JCs and whatnot, telling people to put their social security number on the backs of TV sets. But what good does it do? All they got to do is grind them off. So I think the only way that we can arrive at a just law is to go with the original serial number. But this law is very badly needed.
Questions of Mr. Shields?
Madam Chairman.
Senator Hoyt.
Didn't we have a bill of this nature before the legislature sometime in the last 4 years?
No, you deleted about half of the bill that was on the books.
Some portion of it was passed?
No, one. There was a.
That's what you did.
A repeal of a certain section of the law.
Further questions of Mr. Shields? Senator Keith.
Madam Chairman, I do have a bill in on this subject. I think it came in as this committee's bill very recently. And I don't know, it may be identical. I just want to forewarn you. I think it's another.
Well,
I thought it was a very necessary piece of legislation.
It may be, sir, that I don't know how to do these things in front of the legislature, so I wrote to Secretary of State and got the name of every one and just sent my proposed copy of the law to each and every one of you. Now, this is not quite the form that the law was proposed in. It's been shortened considerably, and my attorneys have not looked it over, so I can't.
Further questions of Mr. Shields?
Does it still say what you had in mind?
Beg pardon?
Does it still say what you had in mind in your
generally, opinion? But with legality of it, I'm not prepared to say.
Mr. Shields, if I had a chainsaw and it was stolen from me and somebody filed off the number and the police got the saw and I got the saw back from the police, then would I be guilty of a crime?
No. All you got to do is take it to a shop and have your serial number stamped back on it, and the police are quite aware of it. You see, you have a section in here that if you acquire something legally and properly, notify your sheriff in writing, and you are protected. Of course, this is prior, naturally, to any misappropriation of that article by someone else.
Thank you. Mr. Shields. Mr. Is it Sherman?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I think Mr. Shields went over it quite thoroughly and adequately, and I wouldn't have anything to add other than what he has said.
Thank you for coming. Next name looks like
Farmer. Farmer. Yeah, I'm all for Mr. Shields in order to protect the innocent that buys chainsaws and like to have some way of once in a while getting them back. And one thing I'd like to add too, I'd like to see the company somewhere or another be forced to put permanent serial numbers on them instead of ones they can just unscrew a screw, throw it away, and then that's it. There's so many products now that has serial numbers that there's no. Well, a two-year-old can take them off and throw them away and no identification anymore on them.
Thank you, sir.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Shields?
Mr. Shields?
Yes.
Mr. Shields, would you come back up, please?
How does your company put the serial numbers on these?
Small metal plates, exactly as he described. They are, we talked about it, we were at a seminar with them last week, putting permanent ones back on them. I mean, if this law passes, should pass in this state, I'm quite sure they do it. They sell a lot of chainsaws in this state. And it's a very minor operation to do it the other way.
What do you think of putting this bill in amendment if they have them put on in some permanent manner?
I'd be much in favor of it.
I would encourage manufacturers to do it and make it more effective.
Be much in favor of it.
Senator John Burns.
How are you going to require by United States law the Japanese to put the serial numbers on?
Beg pardon?
If the item is made in Japan, how are we, by the passage of an Oregon state statute, going to require the Japanese to put the stamp?
You can't require them, but if you put it in your law, they can't sell them either.
It's a Buy America bill.
If you can't
Buy
sell America. It here, they won't bring it here. I mean, they'll require your...
I'm quite sure the Japanese move fast enough they do that.
Mr. Shields, you know, maybe you don't have the knowledge, but if you put the number on in a permanent fashion on the item itself, is there any way to bring out the number?
Yes, we had experience with that some time back. We took the Oregon State Police, and they did bring out the numbers. They did find a man, and I don't know what the disposition of the case was, but a year or two. But they are becoming smarter. What you're talking about is a metal impression of a serial number in a solid casting. They got wise to that in a hurry. They take a center punch and beat it out now, which destroys the underneath part of the metal, and then they can't draw it out.
Thank you.
Chairman,
Senator Iverson.
I was wondering on sub 2C of section 2, where we're talking about repair, and it says submit a written report to the law enforcement. Does this mean that every television repairman or anything else has to...
If it does not have a serial number. Now, if it has a serial number, there's no problem.
I don't think that's what it says, though, but that's what you mean.
Well, as I said, sir, this is not the original form of the bill.
So whenever it comes in, he would have to file a report.
If it didn't have a serial number, they need to report to the county sheriff that it didn't have.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Wallace.
Madam Chairman and members, we are here.
If you'd sit down for our record, please, and state your name.
We are dealers in the city of Portland supporting this bill 207. We also sell a large variety of different types of machinery, along with chainsaws, and also do repair work. We will average, I would say, at least 3 offers to buy of used equipment monthly at unreasonable values. For instance, we'll be offered a $300 chainsaw, very little used, maybe not used at all, possibly minus the bar, for $45 to $50. I know you know that it has to be hot merchandise. At the present time, there's no way to force the person who has this merchandise to prove ownership. At the same time, we also receive a sheet from a colored manufacturing company of all known serial numbers of saws stolen in the United States. And each month will probably be 200 to 250 saws listed on this sheet with the serial numbers listed. Lots of times we do, when a machine comes into our store and we question the ownership of it, in checking it out, we do find it on the hot list. So consequently, we do pick up a few of them in this manner. In the last few years, McCulloch Manufacturing Company has started putting their serial numbers on with screws. And it's very easily, even going into a shop, for the mechanic to possibly leave this tab off, or it falls off, or they deliberately take it off for the excuse of saying that it was in a shop and lost. Years prior to that, they were stamped into the casting on the base of the machine, and it made it much harder to take the numbers off unless they put a new short block on it. And so at that time, we didn't have too much problem in identifying or knowing whether the numbers had been erased from the machine. Also, another example is quite knowledgeable in both areas, that if you wanted a 1973 motor for your automobile, that you just have to make it be known on any one of the campuses, and the following day, for a figure of $75 to $150, you could obtain that motor, which is a very known traffic in units worth $1,000 plus, sold for $75 to $150. And they change the serial number on it, and it winds up in some hot rod car. Where if the owner of that particular engine had to prove where he purchased it, I believe we'd eliminate 90% of the traffic.
Questions of Mr. Wallace? Thank you, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, this bill, when I came in, there were questions of Senator Burbidge, I think it was, regarding certain weaknesses that members of the committee thought were in the bill. Has the committee councilman asked for that?
No. What's the direction that you'd like to see them take?
Well, I think it's a very important piece of legislation.
Well, shouldn't we look at your bill first?
Yeah, I think it might be desirable. I suspect it may be virtually identical, except that the bar drafted mine, and I suspect legislative council drafted this one, and I might look at it then.
Well, as far as I see it, there's no attempt.
In this state would be more apt to cooperate with manufacturers and permanent serial numbers in the products.
Well, I looked first for Senator Keith Burns' bill, and he thinks it was introduced as a Judiciary Committee bill, and then the others. Then we'll turn to, is it Lane?
Mr. Sipprell is looking for my bill.
The Senate Bill 208, Mr. Crawford.
I want to see your definition of permanent serial numbers when you bring it.
Yes, Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
Did we ruin your other bill?
No, I don't think so. I think that the matter concerning the check will let us answer the letters.
It may look like a camel now.
But Senate Bill 208 is simply a housekeeping measure to conform ORS 87.100 with the Uniform Commercial Code. Our present statute provides one making repairs or doing work on a chattel shall have a lien. And ORS 87.100 determines the priority between the lien claimants. The present law says shall only have priority over a chattel mortgage duly recorded. Well, that, since we adopted the Uniform Commercial Code, simply does not happen in Oregon anymore. And the purpose is to substitute for chattel mortgage duly recorded a duly perfected security interest, which would be in conformity with the Uniform Commercial Code. My best judgment is that the court would probably construe the statute to be amended by implication, but as I mentioned before, my business is not to win lawsuits, but to see that they don't happen in the first place. So I submit that simply as a housekeeping measure, this should be passed.
Questions of Mr. Crawford?
Madam Chairman, what's the difference between a
duly perfected security interest in an instrument that's recorded. Maybe I missed it in your testimony.
Oh, well, it says now, the present statute says, a chattel mortgage duly recorded.
Yeah, right.
When we adopted the Uniform Commercial Code, the provisions for recording a chattel mortgage were repealed, and we don't have any duly recorded chattel mortgages. Now we have a duly filed financing statement and security agreement.
Other questions, Mr. Crowley? There aren't any filed chattel mortgages that preceded the code's passage?
Well, there'd be mighty far and few between now, Madam Chairman. It's possible, but very remote, that they could have been extended, but I doubt it very much.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Did you want to say anything, Senator Carson?
No, I don't. I will say one thing that, again, for the record, Wally Carson from Marion Lynn Counties. Came across my desk. Another lawyer questioned whether duly perfected security interest should have been security interest duly perfected, paralleling the language. Frankly, my opinion is I think it's correct the way it is, but because we're speaking about the same thing. But the language, taking duly perfected and sliding it around to the rear, does conform more to a chattel mortgage duly recorded. But I think that's kind of an archaic way of saying chattel mortgage duly recorded. I think the preference would have been to say a duly recorded chattel mortgage, so I would opt for the language of the bill now. That's duly perfected security interest rather than security interest duly perfected. So that's my comment.
Questions of
Senator Harrison. Thank you very much. No. I'm down with peace officers, right? Thank you.
John? There's a note that there may be a conflict if you have a chance.
Don't go away. We want to congratulate you for being a new attorney at the U.S. Bank. We know they had a high price lobby this morning.
Well, you know, so I might have a low profile on this.
Senate Bill 260.
Madam Chairman, I am Ryan Blake. May I say a word to you after this measure?
Yes.
My name is David J. Weed. I'm a deputy sheriff of Marion County, attached to the Civil Division. This measure, what you're now considering regarding the priority of chattel liens, has been causing the Civil Divisions no end of problems. We have interpreted them as though it were an implied repeal, but certainly this measure is long overdue and should be passed. I think in its present form it's going to solve our problem.
Thank you, sir. Questions of Mr. Weaver?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good.
Senate Bill 260.
Change around a little bit.